even things like I'm a bad student, like at the basics of it, you know, I don't have discipline. Well, maybe you don't have discipline for these and these things because you just don't enjoy them. So maybe don't do them. Like I really try to show people that you need to focus on the things that are important for what you want to achieve. You don't need to check all the boxes all the time. I think it's something a little bit, I would say, toxic in like jazz education in some way, or even classical, I don't know that side, but they tell you you have to know all of these tunes and you have to learn how to transpose all of these things, and you build this like impossible set of skills that you're supposed to have at all times, and then you're just pursuing these check marks instead of going with your curiosity. And I really don't think it's a healthy approach to like developing musicians, you know? So I try to get away from that.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. Talia Halom is an award-winning jazz guitarist and composer who's just released a compelling quintet album, Mirror Image, with refreshingly unique instrumentation, violin, cello, percussion, sax, and flute, and both nylon string and electric guitar. You'll be hearing excerpts from the album and hear about Tal's creative process and collaborators, including percussionist Rogerio Boccato and David Leon on sax and flute. Tal told me about some great advice he got from Pat Metheny, whom he met when Tal won the Detroit Jazz Festival National Guitar Competition, and the invaluable guidance of key mentors throughout his education and career. Tal recently came back from musically immersive travels in Brazil and Argentina, and it was inspiring to hear about his experiences there, as well as hear about several of his collaborators, including his band Kadawa, and we're featuring a track from their new album as well. Towards the end of this interview, Tal shared some personal reflections on his new duo with vocalist Danielle Wirtz, and some very wise insights into student-centered learning, which I think apply quite broadly, not just to music. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on all the podcast platforms. And I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the description of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including timestamps and different ways to support this podcast. Hi, Tal. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Hey, of course. Thanks for having me.
I've really been enjoying your new album, Mirror Image, which we're going to be focusing on today. I was lucky to get a preview copy, but it will have just gone out when this podcast is released. So that's great for people. They can click right on the link and go to the album.
Definitely. Thanks so much.
So this is a departure for you with the orchestration, use of strings, and you're using both nylon and electric guitars on it as well.
Yes, definitely. This project was kind of born from that desire to play with strings. I always kind of felt like as a guitarist, especially a jazz guitarist, but maybe even as a whole, like we don't really get to play in a section, you know? Like horn players, it's much more common for them in like a jazz context to like feel that blend of a section, breathe together, blend sounds together like that. And as a guitarist, you're not really considered a string instrument in like the classical way of thinking. So I guess I kind of wanted to create my own context for that and be able to play the guitar in a similar way to how string players would play, which I'm really attracted to. So that textural thinking kind of got me started on this project, and it definitely was at some point always also a place where I could bring in the nylon thing and do things that are a bit more acoustic in nature, which I think I'm very attracted to in like the core of my sound. I think a lot of the times when I'm at home practicing, I actually find myself leaning more towards nylon string and acoustic things, and I think strings are part of that appeal to me also. Yeah,
there's a great range on this album, but a couple of tunes, and we'll get to them, to me, like it's in that area which is closer to classical, contemporary classical music.
Yes, you know? Totally. Like, I'm curious, like, which ones were the ones that...
The one that's Kim.
Kim, yeah. Yeah, that one, for example, talking about textures, that like completely like pizzicato, like first three minutes of the track, that was something that like I was really proud of the result we got. And I don't know why, for some reason, when I hear strings, I think I tend to hear a lot more pits than arco than most people. You know, a lot of people imagine this like lush textures that I love, but as something maybe more in the, especially in the jazz context, something more in the background that kind of thickens out the sound. And I think the way I wanted to think about it is a lot more involved and a lot more active. And that tune in particular was kind of committing to this, like you say, maybe more contemporary classical thing of like a slowly developing theme with very odd repetitions, with very strange like meter changes. And it was kind of like my way of maybe creating an environment that's based on groove and a lot of like repetition that you can kind of like hook yourself into, but at the same time mess with the listener in a way to like not know when the next thing is kind of gonna glitch to the side and like when the development is coming. And that was really tricky for us to actually put together, because if you would see the chart of that piece, it's insane. It's like 7 repeats on this first bar, and then 5 repeats, and then 3 repeats, and then you skip, and then 4 repeats. Like, I really wanted to make it unpredictable in this way, so.
Yeah, it's one of the tracks I think I had to go back to kind of get it. I really enjoyed it once I'd gotten into it. So we'll be putting a short excerpt, so people are just going to get a flavor of it.
Yeah,
but I encourage them to check out the whole thing.
That's great.
This is a short clip of Kim.
What really grabbed me right away was actually your first track, Prelude.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of Baroque feel. And kudos to the string players you hired, Leda Fink, violinist, and Irene Han, cellist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that track, for sure, it felt to me like I was kind of writing almost like a chorale-like mm-hmm. type of thing. Especially that second section maybe reminds me more of like kind of romantic stuff that I like to listen to. Especially Ravel is like a huge inspiration to me. Like, you know, if I can get to like 2% of the compositional quality that like he had, I will be very happy. But it's definitely a track that it's funny, actually, you mentioned that, because that's the first track we ended up recording also in the studio. I was planning to record a different one, but there was like some trouble with the amp and whatever. So I was like, okay, let's just do the Nylon tracks. And I think that track, like just starting with that and having something that is very structured, you know, it's all through compose. I'm improvising over a section of it, but it's all through composed. Very simple, but more based on like the breaths and the movement together. So I think starting from that eventually in the recording session also helped us kind of, you know, set up the mood of how we breathe together and connect to the sound. And it's something that I think I wanted to give the listeners of the album also, just that sense of like introducing the ensemble in this way of starting from the guitar in kind of a soloistic way, and then just introducing gradually what this sound of this group is. So that's why we kind of started that way. And the second track introduces the percussion. So that was kind of the thing in mind.
This is a clip of Prelude.
it's a really thoughtful set list. And I know artists put so much into the conception of an album, which listeners don't always appreciate because they're using streaming platforms often. And I'm curious, as you release this, are you? I know you're doing a live show with the band, but are you going to do any listening parties?
That's a really good idea. I mean, I actually have not had that planned. A friend actually suggested to host one, which will be very cool. And I do, you know, I do hope that people take the time to listen through the whole thing. It's something that I still, as a listener, really care for. You know, like a lot of times, let's say when I meet new people, new musicians, a lot of the times when I ask them what they're listening to, they send me a specific track. And I always like, no, this album, you know, I'm obsessed with listening through albums like many, many times. And we do curate an experience with the order of the album, and it took me a long time to figure out. So I hope people will connect to it in that way and will listen through, especially because this music, to me, a lot of it is kind of intended to be in like a meditative kind of space. So if people can find the time to do that and really sit with like what these sounds are, what the feeling of each piece is, then I think it's worthwhile. It's just hard to get us to do that, all of us, to have an hour to listen to an album, you know?
Yeah, I think that's why there's this growing popularity for these live listening parties. And I mean in person, because it's a very cool thing that used to happen, you know, in the 1960s and 70s.
Right. So you experience a lot of artists doing this
No, recently. I've talked to actually just one person recently who did it, and she was saying how positive it was. And somebody I know who lives in Europe was saying that she was going to some of these listening parties and how great it was. And she's like in her 20s. So I was thinking about it. And I noticed people are doing them online, but I was thinking what a great idea it is to do live.
I agree. I think online, I mean, it's a beautiful thing, but to do it live would be awesome. I think just the artists themselves would need to, for me, I think it's a really exposed experience to just like sit in a room in silence with other people listening to my music as I'm not performing it. That's a very new thing. Like when you're performing it, you're so involved in the making of the thing, but to just sit there and be like, you know, I know this record too well. I know all the little quirks and whatever and like mixing thoughts and this, but it will be awesome to get actual direct feedback in the moment like that.
So on this album, you have Chorinho for Tati, and I believe that's a family connection.
Is it?
Is it not? Okay. It's not
a family connection, but what the info you have? I'm curious.
Well, I know it's a traditional Brazilian thing, and I know you went on this recent trip to Brazil and Argentina, so I wondered if somehow.
Right. Okay, so definitely that trip has some family connection, but it's actually the Argentinian side and not the Brazilian side. Also, just to say that piece was written by an Armenian pianist, actually. That's the only non-original on the record. His name is Vardan Ovsepian, and he wrote it for Tatiana Para, which is an amazing vocalist that sings that duo with him. And a friend of mine introduced this piece to me in the pandemic, and I couldn't get enough of it, so it was clear that I had to do something of an arrangement for it. And he was kind enough to be like, wow, okay, yeah, go for it, and whatever. I have like, I guess, 25% South American blood, which now I'm very proud of, because I also see how it connects to a lot of areas of my life recently in different ways. My grandfather was born in Buenos Aires, and he moved to Israel when he was 24. So basically, his whole upbringing was as an Argentinian. And I also know from my mom and like her experiences with him and the whole family, actually, they went there on delegation for 2 years when she was growing up with her siblings. And my grandfather was very Argentinian, like he was a proud Argentinian. And the more I kind of think about him and like I grow as an adult and like I explore different things. And now with this first visit I ever did there and like got to see the nature of the place and his apartment, that we still have family that lives there and like very special. I I realized like how much he was connected to that place. And my mom always used to say that when he would visit there, he would like lift a little bit off the ground, like he would just feel more alive. And I think some sides of my personality are very related to him and this culture, because we were hanging out as a family at his house all the time, at my grandparents' house, and that's where all the family hangouts, meals, conversations would happen. So even like the cultural way that we would be as a family, I guess, is tied somehow to that culture, or like asado and just like having food for like hours and hanging out in the backyard. But that tune you mentioned, Chorinho Fertati, is more of a Brazilian influence. And the past, I would say, 3-4 years, I've been taking that study very, very seriously, which also led to this trip I just did for a month and a half. I was a month in Brazil, in Rio and Sao Paulo, and then 2.5 weeks in Buenos Aires. And it was mostly to just, you know, learn about it from the ground, like where the music lives, feel it for real, how it is in the culture in the day-to-day. And for example, Rogério Bocata, who plays percussion on the record, is Brazilian, and he has been like a huge, you know, force in helping me like get deeper into this music and understanding it. And also an accordion player, Vitor Gonçalves, that we play a lot together with Rogério, and other Brazilian musicians who live here have really helped me kind of get deeper into it, and actually learning what samba is and what choro is. And it's been amazing to connect to that side. I think that music these days for me, it's like really, really alive, and I'm kind of addicted to it in some ways.
So did these friends in Brooklyn and New York connect you with friends in Brazil? So when you went there, you had these connections?
Yeah, I feel extremely lucky about how the trip in Brazil played out, honestly, because I got to hang out with musicians that I think a lot of people would not necessarily have access to or like encounter. So they definitely connected me to some people. For example, Rogério connected me in Sao Paulo to this guitar player that's called Gian Correa, who is a 7-string player, plays a lot of choro. And I sent him a message, and he just invited me to a Roda de Choro, like just a jam session that they were doing at a house. And apparently it was the kind of like party of the end of a guitar course that he was giving, and there were people that were traveling from all over the world to like hang out with him this whole weekend. So I met them, and there was this amazing accordion player there, Mestrino, who's like very well known there, plays a lot of forró. So I got to meet them and play with them out of the blue. Like, I never met them in my life, but like 10 minutes after I walk in, we were playing tunes together, and they were super welcoming. And other people from here connected me to musicians in Rio that I ended up having like a New Year's party at one of their houses, and met tons of musicians that then kind of became community, honestly, in these 2 weeks. Like, I saw the same musicians maybe like 6-7 times sometimes, and like I went to their shows, we hung out at their houses later, we just played. And I feel like having that proximity and seeing how they interact with one another, and like really trying to jump in there and, you know, immersing myself in how they do things, it's been crazy. I felt like my playing is improving just by witnessing that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And I was curious, although you're so accomplished and, you know, such a professional, yet it must have felt a little bit like being a student again, being with these people playing some unfamiliar music.
Completely. You know, I was really tripping before going on this trip. I was talking to some Brazilian friends from here, and I take things very seriously and very deeply, in sense of like honoring the music and like learning it, whatever it is I'm doing. So I think the 2-3 weeks leading to this trip, I was like, I need to learn all the tunes, and I need to learn how to dance forró. Like, I need to be part of the culture. Like, they need to think I'm Brazilian. And of course, it's not going to be possible, and that's okay. I had a friend of mine from that lives here, and he's from Rio, and he told me something very relaxing. He was like, man, those people would be happy that you know 2 or 3 songs that they know. And then when they hear how you play them, they will get a lot out of it too. So like it will be refreshing for them to hear your voice in it. And I think it gave me a little bit more confidence, but I was definitely, in every moment I was there, I tried to like step into it gradually and see what's common, like how they communicate when they play, what kind of room do people take. And I think the main thing I learned from it, besides a lot of things about the styles and grooves and techniques, the main thing I realized that was very special and different is how humble and how communal everything was. And I felt that when they were playing, each musician was like so in touch with all of the surroundings, the other musicians, the audience, the energy of the thing, that it was a lot more about just enjoying the energy of doing this thing that is part of our culture together than it is to play what I know or like take space in this way. It's not about that. It's about creating a space that we are all participating in. And I think for me, it was like this reminder of like, oh, that's why we make music. You know, that's the essence of it, really. So
beautiful.
Yeah.
This is a clip from Torino Fortati.
Were able to borrow some instruments as well.
Yes, I was very lucky. I traveled with my nylon string because I wanted to be able to jump into situations acoustically, and that was really helpful. But yeah, I borrowed electric guitars both in Sao Paulo for some gigs I had, and then in Buenos Aires for a lot of gigs I had. So it's really crazy how we have this musician community abroad that, you know, once you connect, even if it's just on Instagram, things can happen very, very organically. And people were super generous with me on that end. My parents are always shocked by this thing, you know, of like you go anywhere and you just can tap into this thing and like play together and have friends right away. So that's the privilege of, I think, being a musician. You don't travel like a tourist, you know, like you are, of course, but you just immediately can tap into something that's happening culturally. So that was really nice. Yeah.
And in terms of the language beyond music, like with Spanish and Portuguese.
Oh, man. I mean, I was not prepared for the Portuguese side of things. Spanish, I can speak a fair amount. And Buenos Aires was a relief in that way because I could like understand what's going on. Listening, I could comprehend a lot of stuff. But wow, Portuguese kicked my ass. It's such a beautiful language, but I was hoping it would be closer to Spanish in some ways. But there are so many different sounds and so many different accents depending on like, you know, where the people come from. So a lot of the times I was just feeling lucky I could play because otherwise, like, who knows? And, you know, just being patient and trying to speak as much Spanish or, like, you know, Portenol, they call it, just like a mix of the two. Yeah, and it sort of worked. I didn't feel like I could express my whole personality, but I think our energy comes through even if we don't say that much. So I think that somehow worked.
Yeah. Hymn for Tomorrow, back to your album. I understand it was a long birthing process.
Yes, for real.
And beautiful string arrangements in that too, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah, that one, going back to like the kind of like meditative aspect of things and like the cyclical things that I was trying to kind of write, I had the first part, the guitar part for like that first section. It's like in 5/8, 5/4, just a consistent kind of strumming pattern with some voice leading that I found. And I really loved it, but I didn't know what goes along with it. I didn't know if there's another part. I didn't know if it needed a melody. I just knew that this part feels really good to play. But then anything else that I tried to put into it, I was like, no, it's not good enough. Like, it's not giving me the impact I wanted. And it's funny because that one just ended up like working out on a deadline. I knew that I have a show before the recording. So I was like, you know, enough. This tune needs a melody. I'm going to sit for 2 hours and just sing different melodies and kind of sculpt it very, very, very slowly. And I think I also was reminded in that moment of advice that Guillermo Klein, who's an amazing Argentinian pianist composer that I took a composition workshop with before the pandemic. And actually a lot of the music was born after that workshop too. So he's a big influence in many ways. He was talking about this tune that had like all this rhythmic complexity in the accompaniment and like it already had a lot going for it. And then he said, you know, I just needed a simple melody to tie all these things together that doesn't get in the way but gets this feeling across. And I think that's what I was looking for at the end for this first section. So when I finally found it and I found a way to also write it out in time in a way that felt like someone was singing, but it wasn't on a grid, let's say. It was more floaty. When I was able to do that, I was like, okay, this is great. And for the second part, I had other plans initially. I was like really intellectualizing it. And I was like, okay, what if I take the 5/8s and I make them this, and then I write this harmonic thing. And it just didn't go anywhere. And at some point I arrived at this like other tonality that the second part of the song lands on. And I just started playing this like heavy quarter notes, and moving some voices around and came up with this melody that is very, very diatonic, very, very simple, but always harmonized in different ways. And I think that also kind of birthed the song title in the end, because that part for me, there was like that feeling of like the hymn and like something that is very like holding on to hope. That's a sensation it gave me. So it was very clear.
You're about to hear an excerpt from Hymn for Tomorrow.
And actually, the album title, Mirror Image, and also the album art, I was curious about it. It's very beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, that's Linnea Leif. She's an amazing artist from Berlin that we collaborated for the first time. And yeah, it's been an interesting process. I mean, it's always hard for me with titles and also with artwork, because it's such a big part of what you're presenting. It's like the first encounter you have with the music. I think Mirror Image came out pretty clearly at some point because of the nature of just how the music feels. And I think what I would want to give the listener as an experience, which is just a space to like reflect on things and stay in for a while and like just see what comes up. I think when we play these compositions live as a band, and when I wrote it, that's kind of like the process that's happening internally. But it was also kind of like a hint at the compositional process that was happening in a lot of these tunes, where I would write one thing, like Kim is a very good example of it. I wrote the first line, and then the second part is just like a hocket of that thing. It is displaced by like an eighth note. So a lot of things became kind of like inversions or like opposites of one another. Dusk on Landwehr Canal, the last tune, is another example of it, where the string parts, they play the same pitch collection a lot of the times, but in different directions and different ranges that then kind of get this like interesting rub. So it was also kind of a hint of how the music came to be. And yeah, then the album artwork, it was a combo of a lot of things. I think we talked about the environment in which I wrote it in, which was actually, funnily enough, a lot in Berlin on a trip. So this artist actually knew the places which I composed the pieces at. And that bridge idea came from one of those settings of the places that I actually wrote it in. And water was a big element also in how the music feels, and like certain themes, that canal, the boat, like those are all places in Berlin actually that I wrote the music at. So I knew I wanted to have these two elements involved and something that reflects back at you to represent the title. And we just somehow ended up with this cool image of like walking that path and being confronted with something that is kind of otherworldly and encompassing, like a wave coming at you and you're not quite sure if it's gonna like wash you over, and you kind of like in that moment maybe like, you know, think about yourself and things that you've gone through and see yourself in the water, but in a very non-conventional way. You know, it's not still water, it's not calm water. So I think that's how it came to be. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting to work on.
Yeah. Do you sometimes get inspiration from other art forms?
Yes. I think that it doesn't necessarily come directly into the music as like, you know, like a tool, like thinking about it in this way. Maybe it's something a little bit more emotional of like what, I don't know, like a film or a book would make me feel, but I don't know if I would like translate it in a direct way to like a technique or like a compositional thing or whatever. I think there are common themes. Like I think, for example, impressionism in music and in painting, like I'm drawn to it in a very similar way. And I think that those paintings, a lot of them were also like some of the references for the artwork, and it does come into play. But maybe not in a super, super direct way. I think for me, it's a lot more about like human interaction and psychological, emotional processing and thinking about different like spiritual, philosophical things maybe that I'm engaging with at the time. But yeah, not necessarily maybe, you know, taking from different art forms in that way. Not in a very conscious way, at least. I'm sure it's there.
Yeah.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes I've linked directly to this one, which I think may interest you, with Mark Van Fucht, Arielle Bart, Gilad Weiss, Edison Herbert, Roddy Elias, and Daniel Ramjetan. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project cost me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support the series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, notebooks, mugs, and more, everything printed on demand. On my Ko-fi page, you can buy me one coffee or every month. You'll also find the links to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Finally, if you're finding this episode interesting, please text it to a friend. Thanks.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, Tal, hearing you talk about your composition process, because it seems very much like you have engaged both sides of your brain, the intuitive and the analytical. Is that like a conscious thing, or?
I think that maybe sometimes the conscious, the analytical brain, it hits a block, or at least I feel emotionally that, okay, well, I thought I'm going to do this, but now it's not happening. So obviously something else has to come into play, and you need to kind of admit for yourself, like, okay, I set out to do this, but it just doesn't feel right. So I think it's always like this dialogue of, what is it now? I thought I knew, but what is it now? And it was really cool with the music on this record, because it started from, most of it started from very technical things, and a lot of it was actually just without the instrument too. It was just concepts on paper, one melody thing, or like, I remember this tune, The Boat Drift Still. I was walking through a park and I just started hearing these two layers with the bass and the melody going around it. And I was just like, okay, what is it? What is it? What is it? What's the meter? What's the melody? So it already kind of formulated that way. And then I guess I did bring more intellect into the development of it, but the seed was very intuitive. I think it's always a play between the two. I think whatever gets you going and is a catalyst, like, go for it. If it's just technical, go for it. If it's sitting with the guitar and seeing what inspiration strikes and it actually works, then go for it too. But I think the two kind of have to be present. But you know when something is not quite accurate. So I think that's the main thing to kind of trust, you know?
Yeah. I was also thinking, I mean, you're a great improviser, but this process, and of course there's lots of improv on this album, but there's so much that is through composed and thought out, and it was a process of several years. So did you find yourself revising and self-reflecting?
You know, it's interesting. I revised more technical things. I revised some voicings for the strings that, you know, at first I brought and they were like, this is kind of painful to play. Like, you should write something a little bit more doable if you want us to do all these like double stops at that speed, well intonated. And I was like, thank you. I had no idea. So it was a lot of that. And maybe it was more like structural stuff. But actually, I think the intention I had in terms of the arrangements, it was pretty accurate from the beginning, I felt. So there were small technical things, but I didn't revise a lot. It was definitely the first time I was doing a lot of it, so it took me a long, long time to put all the scores together and then, again, work through it in rehearsal for these subtleties. But yeah, I think it took me a while to get the compositions in shape. But something that I feel that happens to me, at least so far, is that I'm very, very slow to get to the, let's say, finished product of a composition or an arrangement. But once I got there, I'm also pretty sure of what it is, of like what I wanted to represent. So I think at some point maybe it's good to say I'm not revising anymore. I revised a lot of things in the mix, in like, you know, the post-production of the record, but unless something is really calling me, and again, maybe going back to that point of instinct of, well, this just doesn't work, then I think I wouldn't really touch it too much at this point. Yeah.
And I was wondering if you wanted to reflect, like, Rogério, the percussionist, how his contribution, or how you guys met, or...
Yeah. I mean, wow, it's huge. With him, he's actually one of the first people I met in New York, and it was through his daughter, who's an amazing musician also, Anne Bucato. I met her at a jazz workshop in Siena, in Italy, right before I moved to New York. I was there the last 2 weeks of July 2014, and then I moved to New York straight from there. I had a lot of gear and whatever. And we talked at the end, and she said, oh, I also live in New York. I didn't know you were moving there. and we talked about doing a session. So the first session I ever played in New York was with her, and I met some really cool people for that. And I had no idea her dad is like such an incredible musician, which I think also made it easier for me to kind of meet him, because, you know, a lot of the times it's actually good to not come with any like ideas or preconceptions of who this person is, because you just get to meet. So I met him pretty quickly, and I think in the last years, thanks to this Brazilian new Brazilian love and obsession and this band, we became much, much closer. And for me, when I was thinking of a drummer, let's say drummer, like, you know, a rhythm section for this band, I was feeling that texturally, it can't be drums. It's too much. And it's something that I was feeling anyway before, even in gigs that I was doing as a leader, just with a trio. I was starting to get a little sick of bass and drums, because it just sounds so familiar, mm-hmm. and like such a specific thing that you can't get away from the sound of it. So with this band that is so delicate, it doesn't have a bass, it has cello and guitar instead of a bass, or just no bass, I wanted someone who is on one hand very groove oriented, which Rogério is to an amazing extent, coming from that Brazilian background and other styles he's played, but that has like a really unique textural thing going for him. And his percussion set is like, it's insane. Sometimes when I see him play, when we're not playing together, I look at how his limbs work and how quickly he changes between like different textures and different combinations of things in a very orchestration based way. That this is this is kind of what I wanted for this project. And I think in every tune, there's something very, very different that happens with it, and it creates a lot of space in the music. But he's also like really, really good at just giving you like that driving pulse and like very groove based approach. But then on other songs like Dusk on Landver Canal, which is kind of a drum feature under the string parts, texturally there's so much going on there. So yeah, I love working with him.
Yeah.
This is an excerpt from Dusk on Landver Canal.
And speaking of color, so David León, you have him playing both sax and flute, which works really well.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, he's amazing. Like every time I meet him, he picks up another instrument and you don't understand how he even had the time to practice it and be that good at it. But he is. So with flute, it was, I think, kind of like alluding also to that very Brazilian style of that tune, Chorinho Fortati. So flute, pandeiro, and nylon string guitar that started it was very kind of idiomatic to that style. And what I love about David, you said color, is that I think we share something very, very special and specific about how we see our instruments and our playing, which is, it doesn't matter that it's a guitar and it doesn't matter that it's a saxophone. Like, the goal is to blend, and the goal is to find what is the right sound and the right texture for this particular piece and for this particular moment and for this particular phrase. So to have someone who thinks of the saxophone not as a lead, but as within the band, which is a lot of how I think of guitar and honestly enjoy playing guitar the most, like in the middle of things. This is why this band exists, so I could also be in the middle, you know? So he's someone who is able to do that, and he could get like the darkest, warmest tone, and like he has a crazy dynamic range. He can yell, he can like make the sax sound like a machine, he could make it sound like a string player. So he's super versatile within that, and it was really nice that every time we rehearsed this music, he was like, okay, what is it? Am I getting it right? Like, is this the tone you want? Because I feel like I'm not blending with the cello. And then, like, they would work on that specific thing. So this is, like, the chamber music element that I really like. And all of the people in the band, I think, are connected to this side. And it's something that sometimes I'm missing a little bit in the jazz universe. Like, that attention to how do we phrase together? What is the gesture that we're going for? What is the weight, you know? And I hope we brought it across in this record. That's the goal.
Yeah. Now, actually, one of the tunes connects to your band, Kadawa. How do you pronounce it?
Yeah, Kadawa.
Kadawa.
Yeah.
So Sophianic Mess, I know you've played and recorded with Kadawa. It's coming out on your upcoming album with them too, right?
But yes, that's true. Yeah, that comes out February 28th. Yeah, and that we recorded it with them, and actually I even recorded it once before on my first solo EP. So it's already, yeah, three different bands, one solo guitar, one guitar trio with bass and drums, and now the quintet.
Yeah. I actually heard all those versions.
Oh, because, amazing.
Yeah, because Kadawa, you have it on YouTube. Like, I think it's a live version.
Mm-hmm,
so I'd heard that. And nice. It's kind of a funny story, the title, right?
Yes, it's a very funny story. Basically, I was subletting a room in my apartment. And for some reason, I couldn't find a friend who would stay there. Like, but I just needed to cover that room for like the rent or whatever. And I think it was someone random from Facebook named Sophie who wanted the room, and I was desperate, and I was like, okay, sure, I'll give it to her. And the moment she came in the door, I knew I made a mistake already and that this was going to be an awful time together, because she brought all of her stuff from her past apartment into a tiny, tiny room, and it was all laying all over. She was like super inconsiderate and like taking so much space, and she was like a mess. And I just sat in my room that day and didn't want to engage with her at all. And it just like the tune happened very, very quickly by just like sitting there and like playing something that was very true to that moment. Ended up being very like weirdly melancholic in this kind of changing minor tonalities, but then it becomes like this brighter thing that still has a lot of like playfulness and like chaos to it. So it came out of that, and there is a section there where on the record, the quintet record, it's just a pizzicato section of cello and violin. And when I wrote that piece of the tune, I knew that it had to be arranged for strings. And this is like the oldest tune in the book. This is like 2018, maybe, something like that. So when I recorded it solo guitar, I was trying to emulate that. When we played with Kadawa, we tried to emulate that, and Almog, the bassist, did an amazing job to like kind of get that color across. But I think the real dream was to have it with like a string trio of me, violin, and cello. And that was the first arrangement that I wrote for the band. Like, I just wrote these like string parts, and then I was like, okay, I want to do more. So it kind of is the catalyst in a very weird way.
This is a clip from the middle of the version of Sophianic Mess on Mirror Image, where you hear some of the pizzicati in the violin and cello lines.
So it must have been very awkward getting her to move out.
Luckily, it was just it was not a permanent thing. It was like a month type thing while she was looking for something. But I actually don't remember if I lived with her like that whole time. I think my roommates at the time were suffering more because I had traveled and they needed to live with her. So they were probably more pissed than I was, honestly. Yeah.
So your trio Kadawa is like a jazz rock, I don't know what, experimental.
Yeah. We also are not sure. Now we're calling it like post-rock or like avant-rock.
Yeah.
Experimental jazz. Who knows? Who knows?
And you guys met as teenagers, right? Like it's been a long time project.
Yes. So with Almog, Sharvit was the bass player and Ben Silashi, the drummer. We met when we were 18. Like we met when we started college in Tel Aviv at the Israeli Conservatory of Music. There's an amazing program there called Shtriker, which brings a lot of the Israeli musicians to New York thanks to a collaboration we have with the New School. So we met there all in pursuit of going to New York eventually. And we're from very different places in Israel and different backgrounds. Ben, the drummer, is actually the one who went to like the famous arts high school, and he was like the one who really played jazz like with, you know, the right environment or a very good environment before. And me and Almog were more like kind of like from the outskirts. We didn't really have a scene growing up. So I think me and him had a very natural connection when we met at that place. And we just became friends very, very quickly and started playing each other's original music the first year we met. And we spent so much time together. And when we weren't spending time together, we were talking on the phone or like sending each other like stuff. It was just an obsession, and we like kept working on music like nonstop. And there was a previous iteration of that band with a different drummer for like a year, and then we were like, no, Ben has to be in it. Like we have amazing chemistry. And ever since we've been like working together, and at the time in Israel and our first years in New York, we were like rehearsing a ton together, and we even lived together. Like that story about Sophie, it was in the apartment where we all lived together. So I lived with Almog for a year. We all lived together for two more years. We toured together a lot in Europe before the pandemic, and it was like my lab. It was for all of us. This was the place we could develop our voices the most and like experiment with composition. And we all are very obsessed with like arranging and like finding the right colors and grooves and transition and having like a very strong impact to how the music is being presented. And yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy to be able to play with people who you've known now for, what is it, like 15 years.
Yeah.
So it's a beautiful project, and I'm really glad we're finally putting out our second album. It's been a lot of hardships with the pandemic kind of dividing us to different parts of the world and doing post-production in that situation. But this one is a real, it's kind of an epic album, honestly. Like we put so much effort into overdubs and post-production and like making the trio sound massive and very rich in textures. So yeah, it's worth a listen. I'm very, very proud of it.
Do you want to include a clip of any of that in this podcast?
Yeah, we can include one for sure. For sure, yeah.
You're about to hear Salhov Syndrome, one of Tal's compositions, from Kadawa's new album, Post-Graduation Fees. Thank you.
Yeah, speaking of your youth, so I understand your first guitar lessons were with the school janitor, who's like a metalhead.
Yes, that was a big part. I actually had like other lessons with like this is like a cliche, but you know, like a Russian-born like classical guitar player that like my parents kind of sent me to, and I was like, I don't know if it's working for me. But I was in a very interesting school, and I think it also led to a lot of the way I think about things. It's like the concept of it is a democratic school where there are no mandatory lessons. You pick your own curriculum, and the philosophy is that they trust the child to take accountability and know themselves well enough with the close accompaniment and like guidance of teachers and mentors there to kind of pick his own path and his own timing. And if you did sign up for lessons, it was completely like normal school or like university would be accountable for everything. But thanks to this approach, they also had classes that were very unusual. And for example, also the teachers had a lot of interesting interests and hobbies and knowledge outside of the normal, like math, history, whatever. So this guy who worked as a janitor was a metal guitar player, and he had a working band, and he was like, okay, I'm just going to start a guitar class. And he was teaching like maybe 8 to 10 kids, myself included. And with him, I kind of learned the basic of some chords and like Israeli rock songs and like things like that. Later, I continued to some other teachers in that way. But then also at the same school, the guy who literally, I mean, without him, I would be nowhere, was the music and also jazz teacher there. His name is Shachar Galina. He's an amazing saxophone player that went to Berkeley and came back to Israel. And I took the normal ensembles with him, but at some point he was like, Tal, I think you would really like playing jazz. So he was like trying to lure me into this universe. And I was convinced, and it was amazing to get into it because he was also introducing me to a lot of things that I didn't know about. And this was at the time where people would actually burn CDs to you. So he like gave me a lot of Wayne Shorter to listen to, the Jazz Messengers, but then also a lot of really hip contemporary stuff like Kurt Rosenwinkel, you know, like that he knew about. And I was like, who is this? What is this music? And he really directed me towards the right places. He sent me to one of the most formative guitar teachers I've ever had, that a lot of guitarists from Israel actually go through him because he has a very strong method of like getting to know the neck and improvising. His name is Shai Chen. So Shachar directed me to Shai, and Shachar also directed me to a summer jazz workshop that I went to, and he also directed me to that college in Tel Aviv I mentioned. So thanks to him, I got kind of a peek into the jazz world, and I had a little bit of an environment at least to play every week, mm-hmm. you know.
And I understand you used to spend hours transcribing as a teenager as well.
Oh man, I was obsessed. I still am obsessed with transcribing. I think I'm transcribing very different things these days, but transcribing has always been probably the strongest part of my practice in some ways. And yeah, I think I would spend like maybe sometimes 4 or 5 hours a day as a teenager just in my room transcribing solos, transcribing compositions. I was a huge Pat Metheny fan at the time, so I would transcribe everything from him and learn compositions, and I could sing like note by note by heart. And honestly, I'm really glad I spent that time then, because it made it so much easier later to not be afraid to approach any kind of music I want to learn, because I know what it means to like sit with a piece and try to figure it out. And that's something I actually also try to show my students. Like, I teach a bunch too, but the skill I want to give them most is you can figure it out by yourself with these and these like tools, but don't be afraid to do it. Like, that's the best way for you to learn. And at some point, I don't want you to depend on me, you know? So I think when you learn how to transcribe, you also have this amazing freedom to just be like, okay, I can engage with it. Like, this can be part of my life and my musicality. And when you do it enough, it becomes a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And it sounds like this unique school you went to allowed for that time too.
Yeah, definitely. In high school, I already kind of had like a normal schedule, but definitely before that, and even in the spaces between classes, yes, there was a lot of time to just hang out and like do whatever it is you love. And most of it, I think it's the mentality. I don't even think it's like the schedule. It's more this idea that you can design your own way of living, and you need to trust yourself to do this. And I think always for me, I am, and sometimes it's hard for me also, sometimes it's kind of a weight. Sometimes I wish it would be, oh yeah, just go by the schedule and don't feel out everything that you're feeling out, you know? Like sometimes it's good to just go with a thing, but I think for me, the priority has always been, what do I want to do with my time now? Like, what does it feel that I want to be doing now, whether it's like music or not music? So I think having that kind of education, like, and like a system that trusts me to make my own choices and that it's valuable, it was like, okay, then if I want to put music at that priority and I'm still accountable for all the other fields of my life, I can do it. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's really great.
Yeah. I wish more people would go to schools like that. Honestly, I think it's missing compared to like the structured, at this year you do this, in this class you do this, and we are all at the same place. Like, we are not. We're just different people, so.
Yeah. And when you first came to the States, shortly thereafter, you won the Detroit Jazz Festival guitar mm-hmm. competition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm a classical musician, and I don't know what a jazz competition really looks like. I mean, I've talked to a few people who've been in them, but...
Yeah. That's an interesting point. I mean, honestly, that experience was very surreal to me. And I can't even imagine that it happened within like a year or a year and a half after I moved. I sent the audition kind of on a whim. Like, I just played a session with some friends when I was visiting back in Tel Aviv, and I recorded it with friends that I had a good connection with, sent it. And that competition is very unique because, and I even didn't know this, I think, signing up, like, you immediately reach the final, like, just three guitarists. So it was just me and two other guitarists, and they flew us in. The format was really interesting because it was two nights back to back. And the first night, it was a concert where we each had mini sets, like 15 minutes, maybe three tunes, something like that. And we played with a rhythm section that we met there, like pretty much no rehearsal, just kind of like reading the charts. And the second night was more of a jam session setting, which was also super interesting. Like, every guitarist would play kind of on their own. And then we would also play some tunes together, like all three guitarists with a rhythm section or two guitarists with a rhythm section. And it was for a full house. Like, it was like a show that people came to see in this way. Competitions are really weird. Like, I don't know if I would be like a judge in a competition, how I would be able to even do that, and like, what do people really assess? In the classical world, I'm sure it's very different. In the jazz world, what's interesting is that, first of all, in that context, I played with people I've never met as like a rhythm section. So my priority, and I think this is maybe one of the things that also the judges felt, my priority was to make music with them. I wanted to have communication with them and not only, again, be the soloist on top, be in the middle, like have this interchange with them, get them excited about playing music. And I think it really, really helped me, but it came through much more in the second night. The first night I was terrified. I had no idea what I was doing. But I did also play a solo tune. I did two songs with the trio, and then I played, I think it was like The Nearness of You, like some ballad that I just played solo. And I remember that after the fact, when one of the judges, who was also the director of the festival, he told me that that solo piece had like a big impact on them. But then in the second night where I really opened up, like they unanimously felt like I deserved to win that. And it was an unbelievable opportunity because you get a performance slot at the festival. So I brought Kadawa to play that festival. We played our original stuff on one of the main stages there. And luckily enough, which was full circle to me, the artist in residence for that year was Pat Metheny. So for me, I could not believe that I'm there. And there was even a moment where there was like an artist like meeting and like a cheers just to kind of start the festival. And the director was introducing me. He was like, here's Tal, like the winner of this guitar competition, and everyone is applauding. And I got to talk with some really great musicians, but there was a moment where we also had to go to the back to sign a poster of the festival. And I signed the poster, and like a ghost from another universe, Pat Metheny comes from like a corridor and like congratulates me, and like we're talking a little bit, and I was shocked that I'm even in the presence of this person. So we just talked a little bit, and he was amazing because he straight away said something very meaningful, not to me, but something about like about the music. He was like, man, your guys' job is to play for your generation. Don't play for the suits. Don't play for this and this. Like, play for your people. He just told me like this sentence, basically, and went away. But I was like, okay, that's huge, you know?
Yeah, that is great.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, and just, you mentioned your solo playing. I really have enjoyed listening to your solo album.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The Standards album.
The Standards album, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I love playing solo. I feel like it's also, it's just the setting that I'm at most. Like when I practice, mm-hmm. that's what it is. And the pandemic accentuated that for everyone, I think. And that record was a direct result of like the first, I don't know, 6 months of the pandemic. I was just obsessed with finding these new ways of playing solo. And again, textural exploration, or how I could play solo in a way that the guitar represents more than one part, mm. or one more than one role. And it was a really hard process to like put these arrangements together, but obviously I had a lot of time. And I recorded them with an amazing friend and engineer in Tel Aviv, Yair Taragano, and we worked very close together. It all happened in like 2 weeks. We did like 3-4 sessions. And yeah, I think it kind of set the foundation of a lot of things that I do now, just that period of like exploration. And really, the concept for me was to take a standard and for each standard to be kind of a platform for a different space of solo playing. That's why the opening track, My Romance, is all played with harmonics, like artificial and natural harmonics. And I just play the head. I just play the melody with a little bit of accompaniment, and that's what it is. Like, I didn't feel like it needs anything else. And other things are more pianistic. There's some stride tunes there, but not for me. Honeysuckle Rose is more of like a, I don't know, like gypsy jazz combined with like a backbeat type of thing. So I'm very proud of it. It's definitely, it was a stretch to record those at the time. It was very hard, but I think going through that process gave me more access to be like, okay, now I can really focus on each of those and develop them more, mm-hmm. you know?
And yeah. I know you perform a lot with singers. You have a new duo with Daniel Wirtz.
Yeah, yeah. I love playing with singers. I also love playing duo. I think like the more exposed and the more intimate it is, the more your decisions matter and you can feel the energy of maybe just one person. I think sometimes I can be very sensitive to the energy of everyone around me. So, for example, when I'm playing a one-off gig with a quartet, there are just way more people to like be sensitive to and kind of find a common ground and a common energy at that moment. And duos make it a little bit easier. It's harder in the technical sense because you need to cover more ground maybe. But on the personal level and like the connection you can have, I love it. And especially with vocalists, because I think when there is a song involved, it can be jazz, it can be original, whatever, you kind of forget about some of the bullshit you would be dealing with when you're playing just an instrumental piece. Like, you forget about all the things you can do, and you're just doing what the song needs. Mm. At least that's for me. That's like the space it puts me in. And with Danielle, it's been a really special process because we co-wrote or like co-arranged all of this music for this new project. And we just have a very, very close friendship. Like, we would meet a lot to rehearse and refine lyrics, but those rehearsals were half like just like talking about every aspect of our lives and like very deep emotional stuff. And I said it at the show, I feel like what we have in common is like the emotional landscape and like the way we process things, and it's something that we wanted to kind of bring across in the music too. And it's a very new thing. Now we applied for a residency to write some more music together, but we definitely know that we want to record something, and I think the message in our music is important these days, of like being more vulnerable and honest with the things that you're going through, even if it's super hard. And right now the world is super hard in many, many ways, so I think for us it was a space of like really owning what we're feeling and giving a space for other people to have that, even though it's really difficult things. And also for this project, it was kind of the first time I wrote lyrics, so it was a different confrontation in that way. I also sing there, so it's very new ground, but I'm enjoying it. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah, I look forward to listening to it.
Thank you.
In terms of your arranging chops, have you arranged for larger ensembles, like big bands or orchestra, or is that something you want to do?
I haven't. I'm terrified by that idea. Like, I don't know how anyone ever has the patience to like put together a big band chart. It seems like the most intimidating thing in the world to me. I think I'm organized and disciplined enough to do it at some point. I would say the closer one that really appeals to me is the string quartet. Hmm. If anything, that's something that I would really like to hone in and learn. And I think, just even thinking about like a show or an album where it's just guitar and string quartet, I get very, very excited about that. So maybe at some point, but my arranging chops are, you know, I did take some orchestration classes at the new school and stuff like that, but I have to say, I feel like a complete noob when it comes to arranging. I feel like I'm going much more with my instinct of what, like, and of course harmonic understanding and all these things, but a lot more with my instinct of what the quality of the sound and the piece is, compared to something that is more educated or taught. I even, every time again, I need to search like what are the range limits for every instrument. It's not something I have memorized. A lot of the times I would make mistakes in like the octave placement, for example, with the alto sax. I would think it's like higher than it is or lower than it is because of the transposition. So I feel like it's in a way raw, and it's something that I could definitely go deeper into, especially if I want to do larger ensemble stuff. But I also think it's just good to go for it and learn as you do it. I would definitely not call myself an arranger. Like, for the purpose of other people's music, it's something that is maybe just beginning to happen. I did produce one record for a vocalist and harpist, Margot Sergent, where I did write the arrangements, but it was more for a jazz trio and a little extension. It wasn't for something so massive. So I would say my arranging comes more from like my playing and my compositional thinking more than anything else, more than like an educational, technical knowledge of how to spread voices and this and this and this.
Okay, well, it might be interesting to wrap this up with some reflections upon your life as an educator, because you had a pretty interesting path as a student, and I'm sure you respect your students' individuality and, you know, maybe approach things differently.
Yeah, thanks for saying that, because it is kind of how I see it, and it takes a lot of work, honestly, but I think it's worth it, and I think that I never really believed in one way fits all type of thing. So when students come to me, I mostly have adult students at this point that are kind of intermediate to advanced, but with many different stylistic preferences and different backgrounds, formal, not formal, self-taught, whatever. I ask all my students, for example, to prepare a playlist for me, the first thing when they come to my lessons, of things that they have played, things that they are enjoying listening to right now, things that are in their fantasy to be able to learn. And I listen through that to get kind of a little bit of the world. And then what I try to do is I try to fit things that I know should be at the core of their learning, but through different lenses, like through different songs, different material. So that's definitely one thing that I try to do. And, you know, I talk about it with a lot of other colleagues who are teachers, that I really feel like teaching is like half therapy. It is completely that. You have to understand what's the angle, how can you reach that person, and more than anything, and this is a moment that I had that really clicked for me, what are like the limiting beliefs that people have on themselves? I think this is the thing you confront the most when you're teaching. Like, some person would come to you and I'm like, I could never memorize anything. I have bad memory. And I'm like, okay, but what if we think about it this way? Because there are actually ways you can work on this. It's not you have bad memory, you just don't have access to it. Or like, even things like, I'm a bad student, like at the basics of it, you know, I don't have discipline. Well, maybe you don't have discipline for these and these things because you just don't enjoy them. So maybe don't do them. Like, I really try to show people that you need to focus on the things that are important for what you want to achieve. You don't need to check all the boxes all the time. I think it's something a little bit, I would say, toxic in like jazz education in some way, or even classical, I don't know that side, but they tell you, you have to know all of these tunes and you have to learn how to transpose all of these things. And you build this like impossible set of skills that you're supposed to have at all times. And then you're just pursuing these check marks instead of going with your curiosity. And I really don't think it's a healthy approach to like developing musicians, you know? So I try to get away from that.
Yeah, really insightful.
Thank you. Yeah.
So thanks so much for this today. Really appreciated it.
Hey, thank you. It was super fun. Really awesome questions. And thank you for like looking into all of the music and listening for stuff. That's great.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.